from Nashville, Tennessee. This is Keep Asking, the weekly podcast that helps you dive in a bit deeper and wider into the research providing insights into today's church and culture. Welcome, everyone. I'm Lizette Beard, and I'm here with my colleague Scott McConnell and another colleague, Bob Smetana, here for his second podcast with us for Keep Asking, so we're kind of excited about
that. Drum roll. Like Saturday Night Live makes a big deal about repeat guests.
Yes,
Bob Smetana is our first repeat guest.
That's awesome. Congratulations.
Well, thank you. I'm so honored.
You should be. I really
love me. You really do.
Yes. That's awesome. Well, today we're going to talk with Bob, and I didn't prepare any surprise questions. Bob would be great with a surprise question, but I feel like we're going to learn quite a bit about him. But here he's talking, last time when he was with us, he was talking about his research process and a little bit about what he does when he's writing for stories. Actually, Bob, to get our new listeners familiar, tell a little bit about who you are, your national prestige, and your amazing skills.
Or I don't know, national prestige or national bad reputation would be.
Either way, you're welcome.
So I am a longtime religion writer. Since 1999, I've made my living writing about religion. I was a freelancer for a long time. Spent 6 years at the Tennessean. Written for USA Today, Christianity Today, the Washington Post, all kinds of folks. So,
well, excellent. Well, so today we're going to talk a little bit about when you're writing a story and giving the narrative to data. So Bob works on our communication team, which is, you know, right next door to our Lifeway research team. And you'll see very often Bob is the one that's telling the stories about data. And so we thought this would be good just to kind of know a little bit about that process, maybe how he thinks about it. But we thought it would also be insightful for folks who may be blogging or doing their own communication when you're seeing stats and data. What do you do, and how do you handle it when you're unfamiliar and on the receiving end of getting that? So going back to when you first started, you've probably written about data for a long time when you see it, but then was there a big difference when you had to start writing about it all the time?
Yeah, there's a big difference. So you're always looking for a story in the numbers. So you see those numbers, you say, okay, what does this mean? Because one part of the story is so-and-so and such-and-such happened. You know, 5 out of 10 people don't go to church on Sunday, or 8 out of 10 people. You know, 6 out of 7 people think, you know, the
and
Antichrist is coming soon.
And Bob is making these
soon.
Numbers up.
I'm making the stuff up.
For the moment, you know? Just as an illustration.
So there's a story. So about half of Americans, for example, from according to Pew Research, will switch their religious identity at some point. Mostly Christians switching from one kind of Christian to another. From Protestant to Catholic, from Methodist to Presbyterian, from Church of Christ to, you know, non-denominational. There's a lot of the switching. So that's one fact. So what does that tell us, you know, about the way that people think about religion? So you think, okay, what do the numbers here tell us? I think about, we had a story recently about domestic violence. We had a story about our churches want to be, and you look for, like, contradictions in the data. So churches say, boy, we really want to be helpful to domestic violence victims. Do you have any programs? No. Are you prepared? No. Do you think that really happened? Maybe not. Okay, well, so then these data points are telling a story that maybe the churches are not able to live out what they think, or some of the things they do, impede what their goals are. So you're always looking for that kind of thing. Now, it's harder now that I write about all the time and I know the researchers on a first-name basis, because when you just get a report from somebody, and especially if you're looking at the crosstabs, because of the margins of error, you can see a big difference. So different kinds of churches, you go, oh, there's a huge number here. So, you know, evangelicals do this, and, you know, mainliners do this. And then they go, no. Scott or Casey will go, no. With the margin of error, that's not very different. You're like, wait, it's like 15 or 20 points apart. Well, yeah, but the sample size is so small, you can't say. And you have to look at the questions super carefully, because what did you ask? So this, all the stuff about this election, 81% of evangelicals voted for the current president. Well, what evangelicals are those? Oh, they're self-identified white evangelicals who voted in this election. Okay, well, then we have a smaller set of people. I can't make a broad statement about evangelicals in general without saying, this is the group of people we talk to. because you see this all the time. You get a survey. I remember on immigration reform, you know, it was something like, you know.
Again, so, I want to just point out that these numbers are just, Bob is pulling them off.
Yes.
Which I want you to feel free to do that.
I saw the survey about how few evangelicals wanted immigration reform, that they really wanted all about security and no immigration reform. And so you look at their thing. It was likely Republican evangelical voters. Okay, that's a segment. That's not all evangelicals.
Right.
That's not all self-identified evangelicals. And then you have evangelicals by belief. You have evangelicals by denominational affiliation. You have all kinds of ways to do it. But sometimes you use you need a shorthand to say, because you don't always say self-identified evangelical voters, you know, in the survey. But at least at some point in the time you say, this is the number of people that we're talking about. We're not talking about a broad group of people, because you can sometimes use a narrow focus to make broad conclusions. And the other thing I think you find out is I can get a survey to say, as you know, whatever I want. So when you're reporting on it, what you want to do is say, what does this data tell me? And I can find it out. If you are a pastor or a blogger or an opinion writer, you go, I have this idea. What data can I find to make me look like I'm smart and right? And you can sort of misuse the data to make that point, because the data doesn't tell you what it means. It just tells you information.
Right.
And so you have to sort out what does it mean. And you always have to be careful. It's like, am I using this data to promote an idea that might not actually be true? Like, so I always fact check our pastor's sermon. Pastor will be giving a sermon. They tell an anecdote. I'm like, I don't think that really happened. Or they give a statistic. So a couple of years ago, the pastor at a church, the youth pastor, was like, half the people in this county are all getting divorced. All their own. And I'm like, no, that's not true. Now, it is good that marriage is good and marriage is hard work, but don't tell them half the people are going to get divorced, because they're not. The numbers just don't say that. And if you have bad statistics, or there's a way to look at that statistic to make it right, that's misleading.
Right. And I think a good check for me is if I need to be able to disagree with some of the statistics I share, like, you know, or if someone is telling me things, like if I see it coming from a blog, or, you know, someone is advocating something, you know, I'll ask, what are they trying to sell me? Mm-hmm. Whether it's their platform, whether it's their point of view, or it's their product. You know, if they're only using data in this, wherever it's coming from, to sell me something, then that will make me a little.
Yeah. Or you can always say, so I was at we have annual meeting of religion writers called the RNA, the Religion News Association, annual conference, maybe 7 years ago, our old friend Ed Stetzer and former boss did a presentation on how do you deal with data. And he says, the first question you should ask is, somebody gives you a statistic, you go, how do you know that? And you can ask that. It doesn't have to be statistics. Someone makes some claim, you go, how do you know that? You know, how did you come up with that information? And could you know that? Sometimes you can say, you just can't know that. There's no way for you to know that information. You'd need. Or if you did, tell me how you found that information, and I can evaluate whether your process of getting that information is actually accurate.
That's
or not.
Actually a great question. I mean, even for conversation when people are just making some outlandish claims. Now, how do you know that? If you ask in a kind way.
We get questions, you know, have you done research on this? Have you done research on that? And a fair percentage of the time, they're asking something that cannot be known or cannot be measured in the way they're at least framing it. And so, no, we haven't done that, and nobody else has either.
Yeah,
sometimes there's no way to get at that answer in a way that's helpful. I mean, numbers can tell you certain things, but they can't tell you everything. And you have to, And so when you're a reporter, you find these numbers, and you go out and talk to a bunch of people. So I've got a story that's posted on our site today that is about people who don't go to church on Sunday, who sleep in. So I went and talked. Now, it's an unscientific sample. I went and did a social media kind of blitz on, like, tell me some people who don't go to church, because we have data. But we also have, like, real-life stories of people who some people just didn't go because they weren't interested. Some people had been very involved. You know, two of them were former pastor's wives, and then the pastors imploded. And then they were, like, left holding the bag, and then they – and trying to find a new church was super hard for them. Other people were just like, I have lost faith in this institution. Now, those kind of give bones to why we know that people don't, a lot of people don't go to church on Sunday or are involved in worship services on Sunday or during the week. Well, why is that? We get the stories which give some life to those data.
Are you ever, now that you're having to write stories with maybe multiple data points as instead of taking kind of the hot data point, do you find that constraining or do you find that you're able to kind of dig a little bit deeper? You know, what are the pluses and minuses of digging into specific points and really working with multiple pieces?
So you try and give a couple different points out of any study, unless there's not only one or two questions. You try and give as much info as you can. Sometimes it's a little, sometimes there's data you just don't know what to do with. Like you get a question and you go, eh. But what can I, no, tell me, it doesn't fit with this other stuff.
So what's a, when do you, anything stand out about when you're like, eh?
So we did stuff on Bible reading, and there was something about what you think of if you see Bible reading on social media. I'm like, eh? Like, okay, so if someone puts a quote on social media, people put stuff up all the time. I wouldn't look at it. I don't know what to do with that. What does that tell me?
Oh, see, that's fascinating because I'm mentioned that to me, it immediately makes me do a crazy check. Like if someone, because I have several streams, like there's Micah Freeze who has Bible verses running all day long in between mm-hmm. his Facebook Live, you know, things. But then there are the folks, and there's other folks, but then there's folks who'll post those, their angel mm-hmm. pictures, and then a cussing rant, and then, you know, their breakup, and you're like, ah, you know. So for me, it's kind of the self-sorting in Facebook, so.
It's nice to see a Bible verse, but then something. Then I'm like, is that really what that Bible verse says? And then, but I don't think of the Bible verse any differently than if I read it in a book, unless I suspect that they're using it in kind of a misleading way, because it might not really say that.
So is the journalist in you, not to go on a deep dive there, but is the journalist in you, there's just no curiosity if there are other people who do react, people who maybe don't read the Bible regularly. And then they're like, oh, that does that bring something to their attention or?
I suppose so. I didn't think, I just was like, it doesn't really fit with this other stuff.
Okay.
And sometimes there's, in any study, often there's too much information. Mm-hmm. And you can only tell one story. I can't tell you every part of it because then I can go off in every direction and lose you. If you only got, say, 700 words, you only can do 700 words. You try and figure what are the most important 700 words, what are the most two or three most important concepts that I can get to this, knowing that any story is more complicated than that. So any story you read in the news, there's more information. There's a friend of mine told me early on that every story, and he was at the Chicago Tribune. He was an editor and then a VP. It's like everything we print is true, but for the 5% that the people really involved know all the nitty-gritty in that you could never know and you could never explain all the nuances in, you know, 5,000 words. So there's always a limit. If you've got a limited number of words, you mm-hmm. can only say a limited number of things. You try and be as concise and accurate as possible, knowing that there are probably nuances that you're going to leave out.
Any words of advice for folks who are writers? Or who are maybe they're good writers, but they're kind of new to incorporating data in. And we talked about, you know, in the previous podcast, make sure you've got good data, make sure you've got good resources. So say they've already vetted it and they've got good data. Any couple of pieces of advice you'd say with how they step into that in 700 words?
So I would be careful to make sure, unless you're doing an op-ed piece and you know you're doing an op-ed piece for a certain point of view, that you're not reading into the data something that's not there. Because you can have good data, but you can misuse it. You should always try and ask the people who did the research. A lot of them will talk to you, you know, to media and say, hey, this is what I think this says. Is that right? And they might say no. Or they might say, yeah, that's exactly right.
We'd like you to address those questions to S. McCon at Twitter.
You know, you can do Twitter. Pew has people, PRIs, Lifeway Research. Has, right. We have somebody who will probably answer. Now, if you got 5,000 emails, you wouldn't answer. But you're not going to get that many. You're going to get a few who ask you a question and say, oh, am I reading this correctly?
Right. And it would, and certainly, you know, if you have the phrase written out, we'd much rather have the data out there presented correctly. You know,
or you go and you talk to someone who's an expert in that field,
mm-hmm.
Bible reading, you go talk to some Bible reading experts and say, what are they, how do they react to this research?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what do they know about this group? What do they know? So if you're writing about a different group or a different program, find mm-hmm. out what you know about other people who know about them and how do they react. Or people, so with this people who stay home from church, say they say a thing on people who are unchurched. Talk to some people who don't go to church. Ask them why. Get some more information to flesh that out.
I want to set the table for a little bit of a debate here on, you touched on earlier, statistical differences. You know, what Bob wants to see, the kind of numbers Bob wants to see to say this is different, whereas what you and Casey always have in mind of indicating those parameters. Discuss.
We want to make sure that Bob or any other writer is saying something that's real, that yes, this number can be different than that number, but is it actually indicating that those two groups are different? And so we're using different statistical tests depending on the type of question it is to test for that. And, you know, sometimes it can fool us depending on the sample size of the overall study. It may look like a good size difference, but it's not enough.
Yeah. And I want to know, like, is it statistically significant? Because it looks like it, but I'm not a statistician. And then I want it to be, sometimes I want it to be statistically significant and you go, it's not. Or sometimes you say, there's just not enough sample size for me to know. If I look at a sample, it's 1,000 people and the sample slice is like 20 people. I need to know that because I go, oh, I can't really make a lot of claims off. We talked to 20 people because that's not telling you, the margin for error is huge. And so I just need to know that. I'd rather you know that. But I don't want you to tell me that it's not. I want you to tell me, Bob, that's genius. We never saw that. You're the first person to write that. But I would rather have you say, no, you're not a genius. And so I don't look stupid.
Do you ever find yourself on the hunt for something that's statistically interesting? Like, I want to see these bigger numbers, or I want the numbers to be bigger than they are. You know, maybe, do you ever find them saying, oh, these are statistically significant, but it's only 15 points apart? And you're like, yeah, nobody's going to care. That may mean something.
Now, 15 is pretty good. I want to see, something that the what you don't want is a data that tells you nothing. You go, oh gosh. Sometimes the data confirms something.
Right.
Like we have this data on before the election on how different Christians who hold the same belief, evangelical beliefs, had different views based in part, well, people of different ethnicities had different views with the same religious beliefs. Now, they also had different party affiliations,
mm-hmm.
and that played a role. And other parts played a role. But there were differences. That was cool because you could see something. We suspected that. Now, if it all come back the same in a mush, you'd been like, oh, that would have told us something else that was interesting.
Yeah.
But you want the data to be compelling and, you know, the more, you know, if you get like 49-51, that's like, oh God. And there's a margin of error of 3. Then you're like, I don't really tell you a lot. You want something more. And a 40%, like 70-30 is better than 58-42 still, even though that's pretty far apart because 42 feels like, well, it's close to 50.
And one of the tough ones we look at it are age differences, where we might see one age group's different than another, but it's not a clear pattern. What I want to see is something that kind of stair steps up from the youngest to the oldest, or down from the youngest to the oldest. And if that pattern's not there, does it really matter that 35 to 44 year olds are different than 65 plus when the ones around them aren't?
That's the worst. When like the young people are really different than the old, it's awesome. But when, but then, like, if the middle people are just different than
they're
the young
adults,
you're
place,
like,
yeah.
or it's all over the place, and you're like, I don't know how to.
But I mean, that could
sort
be a life stage of life. Like, it could be a factor of kids, you know,
it's
transitioning
hard,
to empty nest. But
not
yeah,
a clear
there's always
answer.
More questions.
There's not a clear answer. And sometimes it just seems like it's like, oh, that's just an anomaly of the,
yeah,
of having 1,000 people. They're going to have some things that are interesting, but not necessarily informative or helpful.
Yeah.
Which is the worst. Right? It'd be better if it was, like, because sometimes you really do see age differences or size of church differences, but sometimes you don't. Or sometimes you do, but it's in a way that's hard to get at.
Are you ever frustrated, like, if you're starting with the narrative story and then you're out to look for the data that's out there and the data does not confirm or doesn't feed the story. Do you ever run into that? Or
no, because then you can have a but. You have the opposite. Oh, so-and-so says that, but that's not necessarily true. And you can say the other part of it. So you have enough variety to say. But it's always terrible when you think you know the answer and then it's wrong. But then sometimes you're like, oh, the thing I got wrong is really interesting. So you can have a kind of an aside that not all people look at it this way, and different kinds of people look at it differently. That's really interesting. And sometimes people you don't expect look at it. Sometimes there's a sizable enough group of people, and they do something unexpected, which is really awesome. You're like, oh, this kind of group of people does it differently.
Would you, and I think this is a loaded question, so I want to be fair, but how do you think, just to folks in general who may want to talk about statistics, preach, or do that, what's the benefit of taking the time to write about the data and thinking and preparing before you're speaking or passing it along in other channels?
Well, I think it helps to always ask, how do I know this? So I'm not passing on bad information. We have enough bad information. We have lots of, and once you get bad information out there, there's no way to get it back, right? There's no way to unsay something terrible because Twitter, Facebook has that button where it's gone. It's gone and you're wrong. So it helps not to be wrong. It helps because you want to give people.
It helps not to be wrong.
You want to give people helpful information, right? You want to give people it's information that, and there might be something in there that you've overlooked. So you want to write it out. You want to talk to people. You want to have as much information. It's like when you do a sermon. I'm sure there are some pastors who get up and just open it up and go, here's what the Lord has said to me at this moment. But usually you look through it. You see what the commentaries say. You look at different ways people have interpreted it. You get some information, and then you present a more accurate response to that text. You don't just, like, make it up. Because you can get a number and go, oh, see, 5 out of 10 people don't do this. Well, so what does that mean? Why don't they do this? Who's involved in that group? What people do it and what people don't? All that kind of stuff. You need more information.
It's so easy to word your statement about data in a way that's not accurate. It's not true to the way it was asked, or it's not true to the number itself, because we process things in our mind based on our frames of references. Mm-hmm. And so once we write that, then when we reread it, we go, oh, that's not what that said, did it?
Right.
And I find myself doing that all the time, and I think I know our data. And yet once you write it, you read it and go, oh, that's not quite right.
Right.
I've got to reword that. Or sometimes I have to throw out the whole idea because I framed it wrong.
And I think once you see it written out, I think this is, you helped me get to where I was thinking. Once you see it and you think, okay, if that's all anyone sees about our data is the percentage and then that line of commentary, is that fair? Can, you know, and if you can acknowledge it doesn't say everything about the data, but does what it say in that sentence or two sentences, is that correct? You know?
Yeah. And so the right word, when you're writing it out, you get some feedback. But sometimes the words you use, like I like the word skeptical. Like if some group agree with this, some people are more skeptical. Well, maybe they're not more skeptical. Maybe that's the wrong word sometimes. Because you need shorthand to make it punchy, but you have to make sure that you're using what's the right words in that, in describing something. And sometimes somebody else reading it going, oh, because you don't want to mislead people into getting the wrong conclusion. But you want it to be punchy so they read it. So it's always a kind of a... And then you send it to the statistics. I'd rather have, like, send it to Casey or Scott. I'd rather have Scott say, that's just wrong. Before the whole universe sees it, then it goes out, and I thought I was right and clever, and I was just misleading. And it's the worst when you get it wrong. When you get an error in a story or you just didn't say it right, it's the worst feeling in the world. It's like, I'm a terrible person. It's just, oh my gosh, we messed up.
As a researcher, my prayer is that we catch our own mistakes
yes.
before they're out the door.
That's good. Before we wrap up, I'm curious, how much pushback do you ever get when people disagree with the sentiment of a survey? What they think they're doing is they come back at you and they say, I don't agree with that, because they don't agree maybe with most people say this. Well, they don't say that. They're actually in the minority. And, you know, and so they're like, how can you be saying that? Do you find folks?
Yeah, you get pushback to think that reporting something is saying that it's true. So like with the election, there's a whole bunch of push, you know, discussion over. We had some research on whether the Bible says you should vote. All these pastors say, yes, there's a biblical responsibility to vote. So you people say, well, I didn't see in the Bible, and they want to argue that. And you'd write, I'm just giving you this data. This is what these people say. Are they right? Are they wrong? I don't know. That's, you can argue with them.
Right.
But I'm going to tell you that's what they think. Whether you think it's right or not is important, but I'm not the, don't shoot the messenger. I'm just telling you,
yeah,
here's what we found. Now, what you do with that is up to you, because maybe you want to say, wait, maybe there isn't a thing to vote. Or maybe they think that because they think of you're supposed to be loving your neighbor, and they see voting and being involved in society as part of loving your neighbor. Maybe that's how they see it. They don't have chapter and verse to say it. But you get pushback all the time. You have a survey and you go, well, they believe this. Well, they don't believe that, really.
And I mean, another example would be around election time. There were people who were in the minority on a couple of the questions we asked, and I would hear from them, and they were just adamant, no, I do want to know who my pastor's going to vote for. Well, it's the minority of Americans that want their pastor to broadcast who they're voting for, and yet there are people who think because they have an opinion that it's what the majority of people think. And we definitely reported there are a lot of people like them. They just happen to be not the majority.
Yeah, those stories like that, what they call the Johnson Amendment, where the pastor should endorse. Well, there's all kinds of people who don't endorse. You know, there's a difference between saying, do I want my pastor to endorse? Is it the right thing to do? Should it be legal? Sometimes people are arguing about the legality of it and not. What we reported on was like, here are people's views of whether they're actually endorsing anybody, whether they're people in the pew really want to know. And in both those cases, it was very low. Very few people endorsed. Very few people really wanted to know. But there's another argument going out in the culture about whether it's legal or not. That's a whole nother argument that we're not. Our data is informative because it informs people about a discussion going on. It doesn't answer that other question. It's just more information for people.
Well, thanks, Bob. Appreciate you being here. And we thank our listeners. Bob, how can they find you on Twitter?
At Bob Smetana.
Okay. And you can find us at S. McCon and at Lizette Beard. And we'll catch you next time. Thanks for listening. We look forward to talking to you. Keep asking, learn more, and do better.